You're listening to Maximum Medicine Radio with host Doc Martin. Stay tuned in or call in. You won't want to miss what's happening next. How do you step into your maximum potential? How do you connect your spiritual drive with your physical path? Stick around as Doc Martin takes listeners on a journey through the seen and unseen, the accepted and the unbelievable. Get ready to meet the maximum you the world needs on Maximum Medicine Radio with Doc Martin now. Hi, everybody. I'm Doc Martin, Maximum Medicine. We're going to talk about remote healing tonight, and that's a subject I love to learn all about. And in fact, the next episodes of Maximum Medicine are going to try to drill down into understanding these things we call energy medicine. Although Stefan, I'm sure, will be first to tell us it's not about EMF or energy. So Stefan Schwartz is with me. He is a remote viewer, a researcher of the parapsychology. He has written and researched a lot of remote viewing, and he just knows a lot about a lot. And one thing I loved when I read up on some of his papers and the things that he gets into is a story about a Native American who did miraculous healing. And we want to start with that story and then roll into how does that happen? What is going on? Are there physics constructs that we can understand? But Stefan, hi, thank you for being here.
My pleasure to join you.
So once upon a time, I believe you were younger than you are now.
Yes.
You met a Native American gentleman who was called Rolling Thunder, and you watched something miraculous happen. And then I've kind of looked Rolling Thunder up and trying to understand who he was, and we can talk a little bit about that. But tell us the story.
Okay. I was a much younger man, and I was living in Virginia Beach. I got, through a very strange set of circumstances, I was introduced to the Edgar Cayce material, and which had a very big effect on my life, changed my life. And I had decided I would read all the Edgar Cayce readings, which I did. And then I read everything that had been published in parapsychology. I started doing research myself. I'm one of the people that created remote viewing. Anyway, I was working at the ARE, I was doing research at the ARE, reading the readings. And I had become friendly with Hewlin Cayce, who was Edgar Cayce's son, who was the head of the ARE. And he asked me if I would go to the bus station and pick up somebody named Rolling Thunder. Now, I need to say, by a little context, he had asked me a number of times to pick up people. It was his way of introducing me to people he thought I would find interesting. And previously, I had picked up a man who arrived with his entourage, and who even brought the pans that his food was cooked in. And everybody was in his little entourage were incredibly deferential, and he was the holy man, and I listened to him talk at his presentation, and I was singularly unimpressed. And I need to say that by way of background for this, because then the next thing was that Hewlin asked me if I'd go pick this guy Rolling Thunder up. It was Shoshone medicine man, shaman. And I said, well, sure, where do you want me to go? What time is he coming in at the airport? And he said, oh, no, just go pick him up at the Greyhound bus station. And I thought, really? So at the appointed time, I went to the Greyhound bus station. And I was looking around the station, and I went into the little coffee shop that they had there. And here was this sort of middle-aged guy in an old tweed jacket who was smoking a pipe and having some sort of drink that he was drinking. And I thought, whoa, this is a completely different deal than this fellow that I had done the week before, who had, you know, everybody was made such a deal out of him. This was just a middle-aged man in an old tweed coat in a bus station. And I just didn't know what to do quite with that. Anyway, so I went up to him and introduced myself, and he said he was Rolling Thunder, and I explained who I was, and that we were down in Norfolk. The ARE is in Virginia Beach, a related city. And so I was driving him home, and as we were going by a shopping mart, he said, could you stop and go in and get me a couple of steaks? And I thought, a couple of steaks? But okay. So I went in and I bought him the two best porterhouse steaks I could see. I thought, what in the world is he going to do with this? But I didn't know. Anyway, I brought him out, got back in the car, and we were driving down the road. And as you enter Virginia Beach on that road, you go through a state forest, which butts up to the ARE property. And as we're driving along, I explained to him this was a state park, and that it abutted up to the ARE, and he said, that's okay, that's good. Could you stop the car? And I, okay. So I stopped the car. I thought, what in the world is, what does he want to do? He wants to go into the woods, take a leak or something? I don't know. Anyway, he got out of the car, and he said to me, please be sure and bring the steaks tomorrow. And he walked into the woods, and that was it. I thought, what in the world? Just where is this guy going to spend the night? I mean, what was he going to do? Anyway, I drove back home. I took the steaks. And the next day, at the appointed time, I was told, I took the steaks and I went up to the ARE, and behind the building, there was a parking lot. And in the parking lot, there were some people gathering, and Hugh Lynn said to me, could you help me? And another guy was there. Could you bring out one of the massage tables? So we went down into the basement and got one of the massage tables and brought it out. And I thought, what in the world is going on here? And I noticed that there were all these people, most of whom were men, interestingly enough, not entirely, but mostly. And I said to Hewlin, who are these people? He said, well, they're mostly doctors. And they've come to witness this guy. He's going to do a healing. I said, he's going to do a healing? He said, yes. So anyway, we were sitting around talking, and, you know, it was getting toward the time the conference was supposed to start, and out of the woods comes Rolling Thunder. Literally just walked up out of the woods. And he walked over to me and he said, you bring the steaks? I said, yeah. He said, would you make me a little fire? I said, yes, I would make you a little fire. And so I built a little fire, and I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know what that was about. And then came the time to start, and these two ambulances pulled up. And out of the ambulance, they brought out on gurneys these two boys. I didn't know who they were or what it was all about or anything. And I said to Rolling Thunder, who had brought out, he had a little bag with him, and out of it he brought an eagle wing, like a half from the breast and the wing of an eagle. And he said to me, did you bring the steaks again? And I said, yes, I've got them. And he said, good. And I gave him the steaks. I thought, what has this got to do with anything? And um, he threw the two steaks on the ground, and I he took them out of their packaging and threw them on the ground. I thought, my God, that's two porterhouse steaks. I just, you know, what? Anyway, so he went over and he talked with Hugh Lynn, and he talked with what turned out to be one of the boys' doctors. And he brought him up. He brought this child up, and they were young men in their teens. And they put him on the. They took him off the gurney and put him on the massage table. And everybody gathered around. So there's like, I don't know, 50 doctors, and who are watching this and being very snide about a lot of it. Comments, you know. We came out to witness this. Look at this guy, you know, making jokes about it and everything. Anyway, so this boy had an injury on his back, and Rolling Thunder began this ceremony. He was sort of chanting to himself, and he would sort of sweep this eagle wing down the boy's back like that. Not touching it, but just sweeping down it and chanting. And it went on for, maybe 15 minutes, maybe 20. And everybody's moved in a little closer to watch it. And nobody's talking now, but they're all paying a lot of attention. And he quits. And he looks at the doctor, this boy's doctor, and he kind of draws him in, you know, gestures to bring him in, and the doctor comes over and looks at this, and he looks at Rolling Thunder, and clearly something very strange has happened. And I can't quite figure out what, because I didn't quite know what was wrong with the boy. And this doctor goes over to Hugh Lynn, and he's just clearly very agitated, and but in a good way. And you know, I don't understand how he could do this, and he said, and my Lord, I never would have thought this was possible. And whatever it was, the boy was healed. So they took that boy away, and then they brought in the second boy on his gurney. And this boy had a big wound in his leg. And you could see it was obvious. And so Rolling Thunder, the whole thing began again, and the business with the eagle wing, and back and forth and back and forth, and he's chanting. And I think, what is happening here? And after about 20 minutes, now the doctors are all, they just are completely mesmerized by this, as am I.
Not snide.
And he stops. Huh?
Not snide anymore.
No. Everybody's on full attention. No comments. And after a little while, he turns and he again gestures to the boy's doctor, and he says, "I'm having a very hard time. This boy's mother does not want him to be healed. And she's blocking me." And they go over and they have this conversation with the mother, and Hugh Lynn comes back, and I said, "What in the world is going on?" He said, "Well, this child has a lot of problems, and his mother is," he said, "in my opinion, she's not unhappy with his wound because he's dependent on her, and it's like he's a little boy again instead of the sort of rebellious youth that he was. And she doesn't want him to get well." And Rolling Thunder goes back to this, and he goes on for a while, and then he says, "Okay." And this boy who's got what looked like a it was a wound about 6 inches long on his leg, on his calf. It's gone. And now the doctors are completely just beside themselves. And so everybody goes into the auditorium where there's going to be a president, Rolling Thunder is going to speak. And they go in, but Rolling Thunder hangs back. And everybody else is gone except that me and Rolling Thunder and Hugh Lynn. And Rolling Thunder reaches down and takes my two steaks, and I notice that they are now all shriveled up. And I realize that he has been stroking this eagle wing down and flicking it into the steak. I hadn't actually understood what he was doing. I just noticed the flicking. But then, as I thought about what he had been doing, I noticed every time he would go down the wound and he would flick it into the steak, and that what he had done, in some way that I had no idea about, that he had transferred whatever it was, the wound, into the steak, and that it was all shriveled up. You know, like you'd leave it out for a week or something. And he kicked the steaks into the fire that I had built him, and they burnt up. And he went into the room, and then he began to explain. And he was, as I say, a Shoshone medicine man and a shaman. And he explained his understanding of what he was doing and how he was bringing about the healing and transferring whatever it was. The way he explained it, I realized he wasn't very clear about it either, but he had transferred it into the steak and the two porterhouses, and that is what had caused them to shrivel up. And having watched that, and I'd never seen anything like that, and having listened to these doctors talk about it and go and examine these boys, it just was very startling and had a huge effect on me. And that's what got me interested in what I would call today non-local perturbation, that is, consciousness having an effect on physical reality. And that's one of the things that got me started as a researcher. Because in 1968, so this was probably 66, 67, 68, I started doing experiments and created what today we call remote viewing.
So now,
Anyhow,
let's fast forward to what you know now, 60, 50 years later.
well, what I know now is that although everybody talks about healing as an energy phenomena, it's actually an informational phenomena, because to really understand what's going on, you have to go back to Max Planck's comment in 1931. Max Planck, father of quantum mechanics, was interviewed by the Observer newspaper in 1931. And the reporter who interviewed him, he didn't give very many interviews, so this was a very big deal. The reporter who interviewed him said, "My editor in London sent me up to ask you just one question. You and Einstein are the most famous scientists in the world. What have you learned?" And I think they thought he was going to talk about molecules and atoms and things. But instead, what he said was, "What I have learned from my research is that consciousness is causal and fundamental. You cannot get behind consciousness. Space-time arises from consciousness, not consciousness from space-time." And that what is going on is that what we call reality is an information architecture created by intentioned consciousness, and not just human. And at an ultimate sense, if you carry that out, then what we call the universe is a manifestation of information architecture created and set in motion by intentioned consciousness, a human not being probably part of it, but that in any case, that there is continuity of consciousness. That is, you have an eternal self, what religion calls the soul. And this aspect of you, episodically, manifests a personality which it incarnates. And you choose your parents, you choose your race, you choose your socioeconomic level, you choose your geography, and you live your life, and you make choices because this is the realm of the will. That is, we make choices. And you physically die at some point, and your consciousness continues. We are never coming back. You and I are never coming back. But the eternal self of each of us will, at some future time, for some future reason, manifest another personality that incarnates. And once you begin to think about this and you realize that the two real mystery questions are, what is consciousness and what is information? And I don't know the answer to either one of those questions, and nor does anybody else as far as I can tell, but those are the critical function. We live in a realm of information that is created by intentioned consciousness, which, and we can have access to this aspect, this eternal aspect of ourself. One of the best ways is to develop the daily practice of meditation, because meditation, intentioned focused awareness, is the key to opening to non-local consciousness. And we know this experimentally, and I guess I should say to you that I am an experimentalist. I'm not a philosopher, I'm not a theoretician, I'm not a metaphysician in the sense those terms are usually used. What I care about is objectively measurable data. So I care about experiments and the results they produce. And if you look at the research, you see, for instance, that meditators routinely do better at remote viewing, which is an aspect of opening to non-local consciousness. It's a terrible term, by the way. It has nothing to do with remote. It has nothing to do with viewing. What it has to do with is that you can, when you develop the ability to attain and sustain intention-focused awareness, you can access this part of yourself, the eternal part. And when you do that, through the intention that you're holding, you can get information about anything. And you can also, when you attain and sustain intention-focused awareness, you can affect physical reality in the form of another organism. That's what healing is. What healing is really about is that you're holding an intention, you make a linkage at the non-local level, that is, outside of space-time, and it's the best evidence that I see is that it's something like a placebo effect. That is, you link with another person and you alter, because of your intention, you help them to focus on whatever the problem is, and they control, because your body is a manifestation of your consciousness, you can alter the physical reality of another person. And there's all kinds of experiments to do this. And by the way, it works in both positive and negative ways. That's where the idea of the evil eye and curses and all that, that's where that all begins. Because we know from the research, again, I am an experimentalist. So going back to the beginning, one of the very first experiments was an experiment carried out by a man named Barry at the Institut Metaphysique in Paris. And he took bacteria and grew them in petri dishes and he had people focus intention, and randomly he assigned them to either focus good intention or bad intention, and the ones that were focused with good intention tended to get more robust, and the ones that were focused on bad intention, negative intention, were physically damaged. So if you look at the whole body of healing research, and it's been going on now, really in a very formal sense, since Berry's work in 68, I mean, it is part of the ancient traditions. What we don't realize or don't think about is that that humanity, over the course of its existence, developed what I would call empirical observational sciences. For instance, the idea of remote viewing hardly began with me. The oldest remote viewing that we have on record, that's recorded, it was in the 46th chapter of Herodotus's Histories of the World. Herodotus is the father of history. He's recognized as the first person to create what we call history. And he's writing about an event which happened in the 5th century BCE and involves Croesus, the king of the Lydians. Lydia is now a part of Turkey, but was then a kingdom within the territory that's now Turkey. And Croesus, who we think of as rich as Croesus because he was the first person to create coinage, coin money, got word that he was about to be attacked by the Phoenicians, the Persians, what today would be Iran, and by Darius, and with a much bigger kingdom. And he was very concerned, quite obviously, because his kingdom was going to be attacked by a much larger force. And he didn't know what to do. And so he assembled 7 teams today we would call them diplomats. And he told each team to go out to one of the 7 oracles of the ancient world and to wait 100 days. And on the 100th day, they were to go into the oracles and ask, what is Croesus, son of Aliates, king of Lydia, doing right now? And to come back and tell him what the answer was. And the only one whose answer we know is Delphi, because that was the correct one. So, of course, the diplomats who were sent out, these teams who were sent out, waited the 100 days, went into the oracles. The oracles, of course, are what today we would call remote viewers, because humanity understood, and we know that going back to Neanderthal, that there was an awareness that consciousness had continuity. And so these oracles in the ancient world, and also the oracle of Siwa, which was Egyptian, or the talking idol of Ixchel, which was on Cozumel, which was Mayan, these were all, the oracles were all made up of groups who were identified as children as being gifted at opening to non-local consciousness, and who were trained in how to do it well to their fullest ability. The oracles at Delphi were young girls who were taken at about the beginnings of puberty, and they were called the Pythonesses, and they were trained in a kind of meditation. Anyway, on the 100th day, the oracle at Delphi, the team went in, and before they even asked their question, the young girl said, I can see the sands of time, the 100 days, and I see the great ocean that they had crossed over to get to where the oracle was, and I see a turtle what was it, a turtle and a ram cut up and thrown into a bronze pot of water with a great bronze lid. And of course, that made absolutely no sense to these guys. But they did what they were told. They wrote it all down. They went back. And when they got back, each of the teams, and they each reported what they said, when the team from Delphi spoke, Croesus got off his throne and knelt down and gave obeisance to the oracle, because he had thought to himself, this, by the way, is exactly the way we would do a remote viewing experiment today, what we call an outbound remote viewing, where you describe what somebody's doing. Croesus thought to himself, well, what can I do that nobody could possibly guess? Because if they said, well, Croesus is sitting on his throne issuing edicts, well, I mean, he's a king, so of course that's what he's doing. But instead, he decided that he would have a fire built in the courtyard of his palace, and a kind of triangle brought in, or a kind of tripod brought in, and a great urn of bronze filled with water and a big bronze lid. And he cut up this turtle and this ram and threw them into the water exactly as she described. That is the oldest remote viewing in history. But in any case, what we have learned is that these empirical sciences, other examples would be Ayurvedic medicine, acupuncture, the idea that healing can be done by intention, the idea of what we would call remote viewing could be done. I would call those non-local perception and non-local perturbation today. That has been a part of human history for as long as there has been human history, and in fact, for thousands of years before there was human history, before anything was ever recorded. And we know this because of the archaeological excavations, as I say, going back to Neanderthal, which made it clear that they understood there was some idea of continuity of consciousness, and that they had some ceremony for it, and they left artifacts which demonstrated this. And it's come down to us, and in the early 20th century, science began to seriously examine this. The idea of therapeutic intention, a group of nurses, Doris Kunz and Krieger, Dolores Krieger, created what's called therapeutic touch, which is taught to nurses so that when they're treating their patients, they hold them in therapeutic intention. There are now hundreds of studies. I've done a whole bunch of these studies. For instance, we know that healing can cause a change in the molecular structure of water. And that is one of the reasons, you ask yourself, why is wine and water such a big part of every religious ceremony dating back as far as you can go? And the answer is, because when you hold therapeutic intention, which is what the priest is at least theoretically doing, you cause a change in the bond relationship of the water, the H2O. And we know this because I did an experiment in which I had people do healings while they had little vials of hermetically sealed water that were on the palms of their hands in a kind of little cotton sleeve. And then we examined that compared to control water. And what we found was all the water were in those little glass vials that you see doctors take medicine out of them. I had them specially prepared. And what we discovered was that the water that had been treated to therapeutic intention had a different molecular structure than the water that was the controls, who were not exposed to that healing. And interestingly enough, because I thought, because that's what everybody says, the longer the healing, the more the longer the healing intention is maintained, the greater the healing. So I had a 5-minute bottle, a 10-minute bottle, and a 15-minute bottle. And I assumed, my hypothesis was, that the 15-minute bottle would show more healing than the 10-minute bottle, which would show more than the 5-minute bottle. Turns out that's not true, because the idea was that we thought originally that what was going on was some sort of energetic process. That is, the healer was sending some kind of energy, which is the way everybody talks about healing. But in fact, that's not what's going on. What happens is there is this non-local linkage, and that the actual healing occurs in less than 5 minutes. I didn't have a bottle.
I want to interject a story here because I think it talks to this. One of my favorite, or kind of my hero when I read about him, is Frank Fool's Crow, Lakota Sioux medicine man. And he was interviewed by, I believe the Lutheran minister was Thomas Means, I think. And Frank would bring the client to his teepee and do the healing over 4 days. And one of the things that Thomas Means said to him is, said, why does it take 4 days? And Frank said, it doesn't. Spirit happens instantaneously, but the patient has to get ready. And that leads me back to what you said. And just for the listeners, in October, I'm interviewing Wendy Coulter, a medical intuitive. We're going to talk about the idea of the permission to heal. And it's like when you said Rolling Thunder said, you know, the mother's blocking me. I think that there's this, and this speaks to why 15 minutes wasn't necessary. The healer himself, with the intention, happens right away. And perhaps downstream on the patient end, the client end, if their physiology is going to be entrained to the healer, or going to allow their information to shift, perhaps there's a need for that allowing.
Yes. Yes, precisely. What happens is you establish the linkage, but if the person is blocking the linkage now, but it's not entirely, because as I said, if you look at the idea of negative therapeutic intention, which is this whole tradition in shamanism and all kinds of cultures about negative intention, we know, for instance, Roger Nelson, who was at Princeton, did a brilliant experiment called the Global Consciousness Project, and you can go up to his website, just search on Global Consciousness Project. And what Roger did, and he's been doing it for years, so the data is just overwhelming. He discovered that whenever there is a collective intention, that is, where a number of people gather together in a collective awareness of an event, the death of Princess Diana, Nelson Mandela's death, the tsunami in Japan, those kind of things, wherever a large number of people are focused in intentioned awareness, that literally it alters the structure of reality. Now, what Roger's got, he's got little random number generators that are scattered all over the world. And what he shows is that these things run 24/7. So they're just running all the time and it's random. And then there comes this moment where there's this collective intention. And when that happens, they go non-random. That's the experimental proof of what I'm saying, one of the proofs. And when you begin to think about this, Van Rensselaer Polytech Institute also did research, and they showed that when 10% of any cohort, any group, whether it's a school group, a church group, a neighborhood group, or a nation, an entire culture, when 10% of the cohort change their consciousness about something, the whole cohort has to change to accommodate to it. And in fact, that's what's going on in the United States. Now, the culture war is really, that is tearing us apart as a country, is about people holding collective intention about things which are not true, but they believe them passionately.
Yeah, I was just thinking that that's related to what we talk about in my spiritual group. We talk about thought forms. We use this word thought forms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is a collective, the consensual reality shifts. And you have a whole group that are in a, yes, whole different dimension, a whole different reality.
Yes. I mean, I'll give you some examples of this. Think about the difference. Think about smoking. When you were a girl and your parents took you over to somebody's house, there was a coffee table in the living room and it probably had an ashtray and there were some matches or a lighter that your mother told you not to fool with, and people smoked. Now,
while she lit up her lucky strike.
Yes, okay, there you go, exactly. Now, nobody passed a law that said you can't smoke. The president didn't get on television and say, from now on, no one in America should smoke. What happened was doctors began to report the illnesses that arose from smoking, and enough people listened to it that you never see those ashtrays anymore. You never see those lighters, and you never see those lucky strikes. Why? It's because consciousness changed. I'll give you another example. We used to say gay, where now we say LGBTQ. Did anybody pass a law that said you had to stop calling it gay and start calling it LGBTQ? No. What happened was a collective intention by enough people was held that that language changed. Or I'll give you another one. Look at the role of women in society. Before 1918, women couldn't even vote. Now you have people like Gretchen Whitmer, governor of Michigan, who are literally changing the culture of their state. Why? Because they get enough people in their state to join them in holding that collective intention. That's why in the last 30 years of my life, what I have been focused on is fostering well-being. That's what I care about. Why do I care about that? Because if you look at the social outcome data, again, I'm a data person, what you discover is that when you look at the options that are available to an individual or a society, and you look at one of them is inevitably more fostering of well-being, more compassionate and life-affirming than the other options. None of them may be great, but one of them is always better. And if you always choose the option that is the most compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being, what you see at the individual level, at the social level, is it causes changes which are more productive, more efficient, easier to implement, nicer to live under, more compassionate, and much, much cheaper. That's the one where everybody says, oh, we can't afford to feed children in the United States. We have all kinds of problems about nutrition for children. And yet, when you look at it and you look at the data outcome, what you see is that feeding children is so much cheaper than not feeding them that you can hardly believe people would make such a decision. And the reason they do is that they have other priorities than fostering well-being. And so if you're going to be involved in healing at the social level, what you have to do is what I call the quotidian choice. And that is every day you make dozens of choices. you go to the store, you buy a particular brand of toothpaste, you buy a particular brand of toilet paper, you buy a particular brand of cat food, whatever. If you take the time to look at the companies that make those things and you always buy the kind that is made by the company that does the best at being compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being, you are voting and you are creating social change that is life-affirming. And if you tell what you're doing, you do it as a discipline, and you tell 10 people that you're doing it as a discipline, this is your healing discipline, and they and invite them to join you and tell 10 of their friends, if the people that were doing this, who choose to do this, just the people that are listening to this at this moment, with you and I, Dr. Martin, they could change the outcome of the 24 election so that it fosters well-being. Forget about politics. Ask yourself, what fosters well-being? At every level, from the bacteria in your soil to humanity and all the other beings that live on the earth, when you choose to support well-being, you become an agent of change that supports awakened consciousness. This is how Gandhi got independence for India without a war. You know, just before he was assassinated, a reporter from the Times of India went up to Gandhi. He was at the ashram, and they said to him, "Gandhiji, my editor sent me up to ask you just one question." And he said, "What's the question?" And Gandhi and the reporter said, "My editor wants to know, how did you force the British to leave India and give it independence? How did you get them to give up their most precious colonial possession? And you did it without a war. You have no position. You have no money. You have no army. How did you do that?" And Gandhi's answer makes this point. He said, "It isn't what we did that mattered, although that did matter. It isn't what we said that mattered, although it did matter. It was the nature of our character, who we were, who we are, that made the British choose, not force, choose to leave India and give us independence." So if those of us who are listening to this program want to create social change, want to bring about healing, what we need to do is to exercise the quotidian choice and always choose the option, whatever that is, that is the most compassionate, life-affirming, and fostering of well-being as you understand it at that moment.
So we have about 3 or 4 minutes left. Would you extrapolate that, and from what you've known, just tell us advice for the people who are actually one-on-one healers? What should they focus on?
You should focus on what is in accord with the soul's, the eternal self's interest for that person. When you hold someone in healing, what you should be asking for is not your idea of the outcome, mm-hmm. but I ask that this person have healing as it would be best in accord with their soul's purpose.
And how can you promote the client in that realm of allowing or giving permission?
Well, you ask them to begin with, do you actually want to be healed? Is that really important to you? Do you really want this to happen? The other thing I would say to everybody is develop the daily practice of meditation. It doesn't matter how you do it. There are lots of ways to meditate. You can go to my personal website, stephanaschwartz.com, and get Meditation for Modern Minds, which is a meditation technique I designed based on science. But the technique is not the critical part. The critical part is that you spend 20 minutes a day focused, holding the intention that you are opening to the soul purpose or the eternal self, however you want to frame it, and that you become a channel of healing and compassion and well-being in everything you do. And then you make those choices as I described. And as I said, if the people that are listening to this show will do this and tell 10 people that they're doing it as a discipline and invite them to do it and have 10 of their friends do it, it literally could change the course of the history of the United States.
I love learning from you, Stefan. I appreciate your big brain so much. I'm going to bet you have a photographic memory. But I love the research you've done. I love what you're teaching us. And thank you for being here tonight. Thank you for sharing that story. But just for anybody who's old enough to remember the Grateful Dead, Mickey Hart had a ranch out in California that he got Rolling Thunder to hang out there. And of course, all the hippies were out there. Anyway, so that's just a little tidbit there. But Stefan, thank you for being with us tonight. It was wonderful talking with you, listening to what you've learned over the years. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right, everybody. We'll be back with Maximum Medicine in 2 weeks and then again in a month. And we'll see you then. Good night.
You've been listening to Maximum Medicine Radio with Doc Martin. Tune in next time while the doc talks health, spirituality, and the impact your beliefs have on every part of who you are, body and soul. Doc Martin unpacks the challenges we face as human beings and teaches callers to open the door between the scientific and the mystical. To learn more about Doc Martin and Maximum Medicine, visit www.SharonMartinMD.com.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.